Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Lori Dickmeyer. I just finished speaking with Dr. Jennifer Altahanger, a senior lecturer in contemporary Chinese history at King's College London, about her new book, Legal Lessons, Popularizing Laws in the People's Republic of China, 1949 to 1989. This book was published this year with Harvard University Asia Center and distributed by Harvard University Press. And in it, she examines the challenges that the Chinese Communist Party faced in the dissemination of legal knowledge, from producing educational materials in a timely manner to monitoring non-state content and interpretations of laws, and finally, by attempting new techniques of law dissemination, meaning mass campaigns, national discussions, and more recently, five-year plans. It was a pleasure to read this book and to speak with Jen about it. Please enjoy the interview. Hello, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Lori Dickmeyer. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Jennifer Altahanger about her book, Legal Lessons, Popularizing Laws in the People's Republic of China, 1949 to 1989. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Could you start us off by telling us a little bit about your background?
So I did my, I came to Chinese studies and Chinese history really out of an interest of studying something I'd never done before, I'd never studied before. I did my, I guess it's high school degree, a German Abitur in Germany, and you study an enormous amount of subjects. I think we did exams in about 10 different subjects at the time. And I just wanted to do something that I hadn't been writing an enormous amount of exams on in the past 2 years. And so I ended up choosing Chinese studies because it seemed a fascinating country. I thought it was such a big country, it would probably turn out to, you know, have something that I could then take forward after a BA. Obviously, as parents are, they were particularly worried that I was going to be able to do some sort of job afterwards. And so China seemed a fairly good choice, both from my and their sides. Well, and then as I did my Chinese studies degree, I got really fascinated by the People's Republic of China. Eventually, then also, as I went into a PhD at the University of Heidelberg, I started focusing on the cultural history of communist China. I was in a research group then called the Popular Culture Research Group, led by Professor Barbara Mittler at Heidelberg. And she brought together, you know, a really diverse group of fun people who were all working on totally different aspects of China, but somehow we all had popular culture in common. And that ended up being sort of the context in which I did my PhD. And I ended up then going into an area of propaganda studies, which was something a lot of people did in Heidelberg, but with law. And that was something not many people did. And that was quite fascinating and fun. And so I stayed with Chinese studies, not something I had necessarily planned to do when I first began, but something I really enjoyed along the line, grew to enjoy more and more with each year, and then was very grateful that I found, you know, the elusive thing that's getting all the harder every year now, funding and then jobs.
And how specifically did you come to write this book and write about law dissemination in the PRC?
So I'm not entirely sure I have an origin story really for this particular book. I'm quite surprised by what it turned out to be in the end as well. I am not a lawyer. I never studied law properly. So in a way, I am not at all equipped to write about laws, but that can be a fascinating vantage point from which to set out to do this. Actually, it was on a trip I took to China at the beginning of my PhD while I was still trying to find my feet, thematically speaking, also in many other ways, but definitely thematically speaking. And I visited several bookstores along the line, as we all do. I was just walking through the different sections, and I must have somehow come into the law section. It wasn't on purpose, really, at that point. And I saw all these comic books and sort of small self-help books and how-to guides for dealing with law. And that fascinated me because, well, I'm sure that exists in Europe as well and in other countries, I had never really consciously become aware of this kind of material. And I then saw that many of these materials had actually been read in the bookstore already. They showed clear signs of usage. And so this wasn't just stuff lying around waiting, collecting dust and waiting to be bought, if ever, but rather this was material that people had actually used, perhaps not purchased, some had been purchased. And that was sort of the context in which I decided to turn what was going to be a PhD about marriage and gender in Mao era China into a PhD about the implementation of the marriage law of 1950 and the 1953 month-long mass campaign, about which a lot had already been written. But this particular angle, this idea of writing all these how-to guides, and then I found lots of human interest stories and an enormous amount of different kinds of popular culture material, almost you could call them, although of course that's a complicated term in the context of a state socialist regime. And I wanted to somehow make sense of what that material meant and who had been not merely reading this material or had been made to read this material and what the consequences of that had been, but also who had actually produced this sort of material, who had written it, drawn cartoons, drawn stories, who had edited, and then in turn how the I think we all have them on our minds when we think about PRC history, the famous propaganda authorities, censors, how they had actually dealt with that sort of material, how they had known what good propaganda and what not good, but poor, wrong propaganda was. And so I finished my PhD, which was then completely about the marriage law. And by, I think, the time I was writing this up, and I had to finish it, it had to get done, I realized that this should be a much larger study that didn't just look at the early 1950s and the marriage law, but actually looked at this concept of disseminating laws under CCP rule from the 1950s all the way to the 1980s. And partly that was because as I'd done much, much more research since, you know, those early days in the bookstore, I had discovered that this 1950s moment of the promulgation of very few laws in the Young People's Republic of China, that was accompanied, however, by mass mobilization campaigns to implement many of these laws, to get people to understand laws, to interpret them correctly, that this 1950s moment connected in important ways with what had come before 1949, but also with what came after 1978, after reform and opening began and after the death of Mao, when we get to this 1980s moment, my 1985, 86 in particular, of five-year plans for the popularization of law. And really the idea then, and it took me a while to figure out how to go about this, was to really take the book would be moving from the 1950s all the way into the 1980s. And ultimately that, with a lot more research, lucky for me, the discovery of more really, really interesting materials that allowed me to look at both how people responded, but also how these kinds of propaganda works were created and how they were policed and what they were meant to actually do and how that was in turn received, that ultimately ended up becoming the book that is now Legal Lessons.
Nice. So a question I had about the introduction is that you say you're going to focus on Beijing and Shanghai. I was wondering if you could explain your choice of those two cities in particular.
So in choosing Beijing and Shanghai, that was a decision I sat uneasy with. To a certain extent, I still am not 100% convinced I shouldn't have taken in another city, but there you go. A book turns out to be the book you write and the material you have. And I do try to include where I have it, materials from other places. But at first, the logic for Beijing and Shanghai really was that both of these, that I could presume that both people in both of these cities, many people, certainly not all and certainly not the majority, but many people in both of these cities had been part of urban legal cultures from pre-1949, which meant that they had a certain basic understanding about law, that certain terms were not entirely lost on them. That situation, as for instance, scholars like Neil Diamond have shown, was quite different in other places, but even in places like Beijing and Shanghai. But also at the same time, both Beijing and Shanghai pre-1949 had been, in their own ways, centers of lawmaking, but particularly they had also been centers of cultural production pre-49. And so as I was looking at writing a book that really gave a voice, as far as it was possible, to the people who created law propaganda, who created materials to disseminate law, I found myself focusing on Beijing and Shanghai because that was where the publishers were who issued much of this material, where propaganda authorities then in turn were very active on the ground, engaging with publishers and newspapers and magazines in both trying to devise good law propaganda, but also in trying to shape it to an extent, guide it, and then also control it and at times curtail it.
And I think maybe we can turn to the first part of your book about the earlier period, 1949 to 1954 now, that looks at some of the challenges that the early CCP regime faced when trying to lay down the foundations for how law propaganda would work at this national level now. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your findings from chapter one, and basically tell us a little bit about why was law dissemination, the dissemination of these new laws, problematic in the early years of the PRC? What was going on there?
So in many ways, when I started really thinking about the book as a book beyond the thesis, I had to ask myself, well, was law propaganda just another form of propaganda? And that would seem a logical, not only logical question, but this would seem to be a logical answer. Yes, it was, you know, just another topic that an existing propaganda apparatus that then would be, as scholars like Michael Shinhouse and Matthew Johnson have shown, be built up in the process of the 1950s. And so law would just make use, to disseminate law via propaganda was essentially just to, new wine in old bottles. And as I then really started looking at different kinds of materials from so-called NABU, publications, to archival materials, to other national levels, directives, but then also internal materials that gave a sense of how people actually responded to these directives and how they tried to arrive at the decision to disseminate laws via the existing propaganda network, as it was called, it became clear that law did not fit comfortably either within CCP rule in general, nor indeed with the propaganda apparatus. So it was not at all clear whether law was just another form of political education, of political propaganda, whether it was something much like science dissemination, which fit much more comfortably into existing structures, or if it was something altogether different. And so for me, the phase of 1950 to 1954 was really all about a great variety of people within what we so commonly call the, for lack of a better term, the party state. We're really trying to figure out, well, how do laws fit into political ideology? How do we explain laws? Are laws with this idea of lawful and unlawful, right and wrong, how do they map on to political categories of right and wrong, good and bad, and how do laws really fit in? And so for me, chapter one really became all about trying to trace, not so much in a clear chronology, but more from a variety of different perspectives and moments, how we get from 1950, the promulgation famously of the marriage law and then of the agrarian reform law, which forms the basis for land reform, how we get from 1950, where these laws were publicized broadly, but not really in a mass campaign, to 1953, when in March 1953, there is a month-long mass mobilization campaign for the propagation and then education in and study of the marriage law. Now, it's important to note here that mass mobilization campaigns, there were a lot of different campaigns, and there was a lot of mass mobilization in the course of the Mao era, but not every campaign was also a mass campaign. There was a difference between a campaign and a mass campaign. And the marriage law mass campaign became one of four major mass campaigns of the early 1950s. And that terminology, that emphasis that this was not just a campaign, it was a mass campaign, and it therefore meant more, and people also read it accordingly, that really fascinated me. Because once I was looking at the internal documents, it became quite clear that this was, having a mass campaign for laws was quite confusing for a number of people. What would that mean? How would laws be implemented? Did it mean that one would now have to stage an enormous amount of trials, of show trials, of educational show trials that would explain laws to people? How would one explain the relation between law and politics, which was central to this whole affair? This was about clearly linking laws and politics. They weren't meant to be separate. Laws and politics were meant to be linked through these campaigns. And so really chapter one then is about showing different approaches and different perspectives on this problem of what laws were, how they would fit into CCP rule, and how one would disseminate them as part of the mass line, which was, of course, very important, because this idea of the mass line from the people to the people meant that laws were not just made by the party state, but they were, in essence, they essentialized the needs of the people into the form of a law, and therefore the mass campaign would give this back, give this law that was of the people back to the people through education and through dissemination of this knowledge. And how to do that then became the big question, and what the connection of laws would be to politics in this context of the last mass line became the question.
Yeah, that's great. I wonder if you could also briefly discuss, you had this discussion of CCP ideology, of what these laws meant for the people and what they meant for the non-people. I thought that was an interesting distinction that was being made.
Oh, that was a copy editing nightmare.
Oh, really?
Trying to ensure trying to ensure that when you write about people and then you write about the people with a capital P, to actually get this consistently right throughout the book. Mm. Because, of course, when we talk, so there, one talks about people as generally being, you know, everyone. But in the context of CCP ideology, as many before me have, of course, discussed, Renmin, that is, the people with a capital P, were to be separated from the non-people, those who did not classify as part of the people and part of those who belonged to the good classes. And this meant that laws within CCP ideology, laws would be an, well, today we would say instrument, at the time the common language was a weapon of the people with a capital P, to liberate themselves, to be used as a weapon of the ruling classes. So with the people with a capital P now being the ruling classes, laws would be their weapon. And on the other hand, laws would be a weapon to educate, but then also control and, where necessary, punish those who were not part of the people with a capital P. Now, that was already on paper a rather difficult distinction to make, and to make consistently over different over the course of different publications and different directives, but it got far more difficult to apply in practice in the course of the 1950s and then early 1960s, which is partly perhaps the reason why law propaganda and the dissemination of laws gets practiced at sometimes, but then also as a technique abandoned at others because of its, and I'm sure we'll talk about those later on, its unintended consequences or unanticipated consequences. And so as the people with a capital P and the category of the non-people over time changed, and this happens in the course of the 50s and the 60s, who needed to be educated in laws and how and to what extent became a far more murky question. The other problem was that, although sort of in theory the idea would be that, well, if laws are a product of the mass line, that is, if they are the essence of what people want, put into legal form and returned to them through education, well, then the people from whom, with a capital P, from whom these laws, of these ideas for the law, the needs for the laws are taken, well, then they would intuitively embrace them with some education and with some, with given access to this knowledge, but there would be sort of an intuitive knowledge of what these laws would be about. In practice, that did not work. And so education became as much about the mass line of educating people in the laws, because this was part of being of being a citizen, part of the people in the socialist society to come. But it also became mass mobilization for laws and legal education of the general population, then also became a technique by which to control how the people with a capital P understood laws and to try and ensure that they understood them consistent with how party state authorities wanted these laws to be interpreted and understood.
Okay, why don't we turn to your next chapter, which talks about the publishing field in around this time. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about what did the publishing landscape for materials related to laws look like in the early 1950s? And what kind of relationship did these various publishing entities have with the government or the CCP?
A complicated one, to say the least. So I got started when I keep on going back to when I got started with this book, but I think in many ways this book entailed an enormous amount of surprises for me. So when I first looked at the people who were producing, we started to trace the people who were producing this kind of law propaganda for the marriage law, but then also for the discussion of the first state constitution in 1954. I also began tracing the publishing houses that issued these materials. And thankfully, there are some fantastic published compendia of materials on the history of publishing under in the People's Republic of China. And these contained an enormous a wealth of documents about the transformation of private publishers into joint state-private and then state-owned publishing houses. And as I discovered, as I started tracing the names of my different publishers, many of them were actually private publishers. And so in these documents, slowly but surely, the picture that emerged and that then ultimately became the basis for Chapter 2, together with many archival materials that I later, that I then found as well, the picture that emerged was one in which private publishers, many small to medium sized, not merely the very big ones, had been very active in creating a diversity of propaganda materials between 1950 and 1952 that then become the basis on which laws are disseminated. And I didn't want to automatically presume that, you know, you have a private publisher, hence the content of that material is more problematic. That's an assumption that many CCP officials made by default. That's not what I was trying to do. But what was clear is that these private publishers worked in different ways. They were, at least between 50 and 53, under different supervision structures than state-owned publishing houses. State-owned publishing houses, in turn, could not nearly issue the kind of propaganda variety that was often needed or desired for these kinds of campaigns. And so that meant that when looking at the early 1950s and this moment of trying to figure out, of many people trying to figure out, how do we disseminate laws in the best form? How do we ensure consistency of message across different different media and then across different, you know, different, say, within print media, different publications within print media? I was actually dealing, and people at the time were dealing, with a quite diverse publishing field. And that meant that one of the key forms of propaganda, namely print propaganda, other forms of propaganda were equally important, but print propaganda really mattered quite a bit. That print propaganda, in turn, for one, was produced by within the context of a diverse publishing field. It was produced within the context in which publishers very often, particularly private publishers, very often were actually censored after publication, not before, so that things could be circulating that later on censors decided were not actually ideal propaganda and they wanted it off the market, but it would already be in circulation. And that meant that this idea of a consistent message of what laws were actually about was that even the attempt to get that consistency of message was to a certain extent already, if it wasn't broken, it at least was challenged in the course of even just producing these materials. And so that became Chapter 2, because then the marriage law, one of my big case studies for the 1950s, turned out also to be a major major moment for the publishing industry as government publishing authorities tried to use the case of marriage law implementation, which had seen so many private publishers involved, as a case study for why more control of state of publishing houses was necessary. And so the marriage law gets turned into a case of showing how things go wrong if you have private publishers and how you get a diversity of messages that is a problem potentially for the government and for party. And so that's essentially what I try to trace in Chapter 2. It is, I think, perhaps my most geeky chapter of all. I also quite enjoyed it. It sort of takes a very narrow case approach, but it is quite fascinating in the sense that you then get state-owned publishing houses, and this is one of the big examples I use, trying to put out, if not the diversity of publications, because they did not focus on diversity as much as on having one model of propaganda that had been carefully vetted at all stages of party and government, and then to take this one model forward and just publish it in absolutely huge print runs of several million copies. And that happens in the course, for instance, of the dissemination of the so-called regulations for the punishment of counter-revolutionaries, which is in the context of the campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries, but then is also is also a booklet, a kind of booklet that's issued in the context of the marriage law campaign. And these booklets, in turn, have their own very interesting history. Both these booklets published in the millions that I trace in chapter two, on the one hand, became very famous. They were then also serialized in newspapers. They did something which was a format we see until today. They would have one article. For each article, you would have one image. And so it was trying to make the law particularly accessible by trying to visualize how each article would look implemented in China's new society. And this format, on the one hand, as I said, was particularly popular. It then gets serialized. It also gets turned into exhibitions where these booklet images become big posters that exhibition docents then lead groups through explaining what the laws are all about. But on the other hand, these two booklets about the campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries and about the implementation of the marriage law then become famous examples of a so-called allotment crisis in the publishing field, where it turned out by early 1953 and then into spring 1953, just as the marriage law campaign unfolds, that in fact, rather than trying to entice people to purchase these volumes or entice them to read them, local cadres in many counties had in fact forcefully allotted and made people pay for these volumes, even if the villages or particularly the households which they may purchase a copy actually only had illiterate people. And so that in turn becomes this mini moment of crisis in the publishing field, which then sort of circles around the fear of how to produce, well, for the one, how to produce good law propaganda, but then also how to ensure that the way law propaganda is brought to, quote unquote, the people is not such that people get very annoyed, both with the medium as well as with the message, and then prove perfectly unwilling to engage with any of it.
Yeah, so you talk a lot more about the marriage law in the following chapter. And this next part of your book talks about two case studies, the marriage law and its dissemination, and also the constitution draft the next year after that. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about what was the marriage law. You discuss the basic spirit of that. What's the issue there?
The issue with the marriage law. So the marriage law is one of, famously, this is, I mean, a lot, an enormous amount has been written on the marriage law. This is quite a wonderful field to be working in, at the same time also very daunting. The marriage law, together with land reform, is and the agrarian reform law, are often seen as the two basic laws of any new communist regime following in the footsteps of the Soviet Union. And so the marriage law really was all about trying to outline what they called a so-called new democratic. We're still in the phase of new democracy in the early 1950s, and this is 1950 when it gets promulgated, a new democratic marriage system. Later on, this very same new democratic marriage system is relabeled the socialist marriage system. And the idea outlined in the general principles is that the new marriage system would mean state protection of the freedom to marry and divorce, gender equality, monogamy, happiness, harmony, and love, so that happy and harmonious couples and families would be able to work towards that socialist utopia. To be happy and harmonious would enable production, and production in turn was for the good of the entire country. And at the same time, these general principles, so in the first articles of the marriage law, then also outlaw what they call the feudal, later on sometimes also dubbed the old marriage system, which is all about arbitrary and compulsory arrangements and the supremacy of man over woman. I'm quoting here, disregard of children, and basically things like bigamy, concubinage, child betrothal, interference in the remarriage of widows, etc. And so the idea of the marriage law really was, and this is often how it's been discuss to fundamentally reshape the nature of both relations between men and women, but also family relations overall.
Mm.
And so in, if I understood your question correctly, then in the campaign, this becomes all about how to explain these principles in a way that people, and this marriage law had led both famously this, I'm making use here of a rich body of scholarship that has looked at the consequences, social consequences of the marriage law. And we get both an increase, famously, of people on the one hand trying to use this law, but then also people becoming very worried about the consequences of the law. It might be breaking up families, that it might lead women to freely divorce, that it might, and this happens quite a bit, as others have described, that it might lead men to simply decide that they don't like their wife anymore, they want another wife, that it leads to, and this happens in 50, 51, 52, to also to attacks on mothers-in-law, but then it also leads to an enormous amount of violence against women who are trying to make use of this marriage law. The suicide rate increases exponentially. And so in the context of this moment, then explaining the marriage law in the way that by 1953, the party had decided it was meant to be understood, that becomes the focus of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. And you also use this chapter to discuss the importance of models being used in this first campaign. I wonder if you could talk about that a little.
Well, models were everywhere. The model becomes essential to trying and link political visions of what model families, model individuals, model couples, model village communities should look like to the otherwise very simple and broad stipulations of the marriage law. Now, it's worth remembering that when you read the marriage law today, many of the things that it stipulates would not strike us as particularly revolutionary anymore, but at the time they were. And so, but they were phrased in a way that was not automatically fitting these legal articles into the political vision of the CCP. And so models served in a way to tie what was called the basic spirit, which was the basic spirit sort of encapsulates these first that I was just talking about, these first articles of the marriage law, both the abolishing of the old marriage system, the feudal marriage system, and the institution of the new democratic new marriage system. So these general principles were then explained as being the basic spirit of the law, and models would be the way to translate the basic spirit of the marriage law into tropes of everyday life of families and couples and social groups under CCP rule. And so models, we've had a lot of fantastic scholarship about models. And so on the basis of that, I was really able to look at what do models mean when we have a campaign for law. Is there any difference in how sort of what the sort of function models then have? And as I just said, these models become embodiments of the basic spirit, but in a way that allows propaganda to link what is really written in the law with political visions of how people should live. So we get a strong connection through the model between simple, accessible but also quite vague legal articles and very concrete ideas about who the new socialist man, woman, and family is, how they look like, what they wear, how they behave. And in linking this basic spirit and actual implementation of the law through cultural production, models then become sort of a typified version that really embodies not merely the lawful and the unlawful, but also the right and wrong and the good and bad. And so I use, for example, a few example images in the book that show that when legal articles were explained in saying, you know, this used to be unlawful and now this is lawful, very often they would juxtapose images of pre-49 and post-49 China. And by association, the argument was therefore, if you were a couple wearing the following, you know, you have a top hat on, you look like a Republican couple, and you're in this image of an unlawful marriage, then wearing this, looking like this by association, it is suggested this is too is unlawful and feudal. So what was feudal by association became unlawful. And so these models allowed cultural workers who produced these materials to really create a narrative of what laws would really look like when they were implemented in society. That still is a far cry from what many people then experienced the implementation of the marriage law to be, but at least in terms of propaganda materials, it allows this crucial link between law and politics that was not there by default. It had to be created, and models are one mode of transmission for creating this link between law and political visions. Hmm.
And then your next chapter looks at the 1954 state constitution draft discussion. And you say that this is really taking legal learning to a new level because it's being presented as a national discussion. Could you talk about how different it was, or why was there this shift in the first place?
The shift from
having a mass campaign like the marriage law to more of a national discussion. What's that shift, or why is there that shift?
The state constitution discussion, it builds on the 1936 discussion of the state constitution draft in the Soviet Union. And so in many ways, there was sort of a blueprint for the PRC to do this in the context of 1954 is a very important moment for this, in the context of solidifying new structures for the state. Now, the marriage law had been not been in that way a participatory activity, in that people just learned the law, they hadn't participated in its drafting. And this was meant to be very different for the state constitution. The logic here was that in making people, and this is, we're back to the Maslin logic, in involving as many people as possible in discussing a draft, getting in some form, whether or not it matters is another thing, getting their feedback and incorporating, at least in theory, incorporating or at least acknowledging this feedback, and then passing this new state constitution, everybody through their participation, through this Maslin logic, would therefore also be responsible for adhering to the state constitution. And so this, I think, is a step from where we had been in 1950 when the first laws were passed, from just passing of laws and then their dissemination and people being educated in these laws, to this point in 1954 when people are made complicit, or at least involved in the process of, theoretically involved in the process of making these laws, and therefore then also become responsible once the state constitution is passed for, and this is really key, abiding by the constitution. So the logic is, through participation, once then this law is passed, you have an obligation to also abide by it, because the state constitution is the law of the people, the major law of the people. And so in the chapter, I tried, through many different examples, both from the point of actually organizing the state constitution, you know, what you could actually publish about openly, what was going on in the discussion of the state constitution, and what material had to then be published internally, mostly stuff that was going wrong, to the point of thinking about how did people actually respond to learning about the state constitution. And there were some very curious responses that made sense, but they were nonetheless in their own way curious, to the point of creating and then also policing materials that drive home this message that the state constitution is the major, sometimes also called the mother law of the people, and therefore they have a duty to abide by it. A logic, by the way, a rationale which we still see being used today in the context of the state constitution. So that was sort of the step from chapter two of, and chapter three to chapter four.
And why don't we skip ahead now to the later period that you cover in your book, following the Cultural Revolution, where you discuss basically new attempts to institute law propaganda during this pretty new era. So what is basically the goal or the goals of these kind of late 1970s, early 1980s law propaganda? What are they trying to do and how does it link back to what we've seen before?
So, chapter five takes us into the post-78 period, but it starts in 1970, and this was quite important in my opinion. And I literally stumbled across some archival materials in Shanghai that while I was looking for various responses to different state constitutions from 1954 all the way into the 1980s, and there were in fact archival materials for the 1982 discussion of the state constitution draft, I actually happened upon the 1970s, a few, not many, 1970s documents that really showed how people in 1970 discussed very briefly a draft for a new state constitution. Now, we know this has been a famous episode in the history of the Cultural Revolution, this moment of elite party leadership contestations that erupt over this constitution and over the question of the state sort of state and party leadership. But what I had not known and what I could find very little discussion of was that there had been a public, at least in Shanghai, but also it turns out now in other cities, there had been a public discussion of this draft. And this draft then, it is not promulgated in 1970. It becomes the basis for the famous 1975 constitution. And then we go into a phase of new constitutions. So we go from 1975 to 1978 and 1982. But really what I then call a decade of Chinese constitutions started at the height of the Cultural Revolution. And this little fact mattered because it meant that people in 1970 had actually restarted studying laws and had thought about sort of what was going on at that moment in the context of a new state constitution. And they didn't actually forget that by the time we get to 1978-79 and the promulgation of a new constitution. However, official rhetoric told quite a different story. And namely, that's where we have often presumed that 1976, the death of Mao, and then 1978, the beginning, December 1978, the beginning of reform and opening, had been the beginning, also the beginning of a new era of legal reform, and therefore a new era for people to have laws, to use laws, and to learn about, and then think about laws and their role in their everyday lives. And so clearly 1970, for one, upset that story, but it also meant that a very popular trope of the Cultural Revolution, at least, had to be examined quite critically, and that was the trope of lawless China and the lawless Cultural Revolution. Now, I should say right up front that my book does not, and I personally would not ever intend to question many of the excellent scholarship we have that show that in practice, just how lawless in practice the Cultural Revolution was. But the point was that lawlessness as a term, actually, it was part of a famous late 1960s People's Daily article. It was not an editorial. This is actually a point I tried to make. It was not an editorial. It becomes known as an editorial, although it is not one. But in that moment, we get this term lawlessness. And this term lawlessness becomes very prominent in the late 70s and early 80s to describe, in hindsight, what had happened in the Cultural Revolution. And so the Cultural Revolution quickly becomes this 10 years of lawlessness. And so the logic, given that people had gone through this phase of lawlessness and there was now a new era under CCP rule post-78 that had new laws, people, everyone would have to be educated in new laws in order for lawlessness not to become all pervasive again. And so chapter 5 really tries to somehow trace how the CCP tried to, and in some ways managed, and in some other ways did not manage, to create a narrative of a new socialist society and a new kind of CCP rule post-78. And here it's worth remembering that this was the same party that had taken China into the Cultural Revolution. So in some ways, laws become one instrument to try and graft a new narrative for what post-Cultural Revolution China was going to be all about. And in this context, then, popularizing laws has a powerful new rationale, and that namely is to help people understand how not to be lawless on the assumption that everybody would be, and how to use propaganda in an efficient way that ensures that people know how properly to understand these new laws and how to live by them. And so that really became the focus of chapter 5.
And then in chapter 6, we see a further development, which you referenced before, the fact that there is the first 5-year plan that is supposed to deal with the popularization of common legal knowledge, making it kind of a regular technique of the CCP. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the broad strokes of this plan. How did it try to use new media, things of that nature?
So by 1985, a decision was reached in late 1985 that there would be a 5-year plan for the popularization of legal knowledge, much that like there had been institutionalized plans for the popularization of scientific knowledge. And by that point, after 78, laws had become, and you see this term being used today, still scientific. So the idea was that if laws are scientific, they can be understood and taught in a scientific manner. And this 5-year plan was meant to do that. It first focuses on cadres and then on youth. And this idea, and this has been discussed in many works on the 1980s, 70s and 80s in China, youth become sort of a broad group that is understood to be particularly in danger of being corrupted because they grew up during the Cultural Revolution, and therefore the assumption is they would know nothing about laws and they would need to be educated in laws in order to become good and law-abiding citizens. Now, the curious thing of this 1985 5-year plan that then begins in 1986 is really that it brings together a wide group of people within sort of central party leadership who probably otherwise did not necessarily agree on the way forward for post-78 China, but they did agree that knowing laws was a good thing, either because, but sort of schematically put, either because it would be a way to hold the state accountable, or because it would be a way to control how citizens understood laws and to ensure that they understood them correctly. And I just wanted to add here, this idea of what the correct and incorrect understanding of laws is a constant matter for debate from the 50s all the way until the 1980s. And it is not at all clear, even to censors at all times, what exactly the correct interpretation of these laws is. And so 1985, that was a time, you have TV. By that point, so you get where you had previously had a lot of print material for laws, you would have theater plays and operas in the 1950s, you would have cartoons, human interest stories, you would have newspaper reading groups, a lot of radio broadcasting. In the 1980s, TV had become a very important component of law propaganda and remains until today. At the same time, the 1980s media landscape was, a far cry from the 1950s, although it did share some commonalities, of course, in terms of the return of a more diverse publishing landscape that we had also had in the early 1950s. And so these new media meant that creating law propaganda that would actually interest people could be quite difficult, especially if making law propaganda also meant making law propaganda that could pass the critical eye of censors. The problem was here, you didn't want to make it too gory. You didn't want to make it too violence prone. That was something that constantly appears in internal documents. Law propaganda should not only emphasize crime, it should also talk about civic duty, and it should talk about how to lead a good socialist life. The question was then, for instance, also about how to avoid creating law propaganda that may accidentally show loopholes in the law that then people could exploit if they wanted to. And so this mid-1980s moment for me very much becomes dominated by a search for reliable, attractive propaganda that can get people to actually pay attention to law. And let's be honest, learning about laws is not the most interesting of things necessarily. And if you have a choice between, one form of reading material and legal education material, chances are all of us wouldn't be going for the legal education material at first. And this is clearly a problem straight from the 50s all the way into the 80s. So how to make it once attractive and on the other hand also safe for dissemination, at least from the perspective of party state officials, was this big question. And one format particularly stood out to me, and that was the appearance of legal knowledge contests, which become really popular in the second half then of the 1980s in the course of this first five-year plan, in which you would have either magazine-based, or you would have this in the context of work unit or municipal level or district level competitions, where people would study laws in order to be able then in a competition to answer questions correctly, and then in turn obtain a badge or a certificate, if they did particularly well, one associated with a prize, to show that they had really understood the laws. They could explain the laws to others. They could be good models. We're back to models of popularizing laws, and they could be good citizens. So this idea of the good law-abiding citizen becomes very important in the course of the 1980s. And then it sort of ties in with patriotic education. It ties in with education in morals, in also for youth, in being polite, and so law becomes part of all of this broader attempt to create the good socialist citizen.
And we're kind of running out of time here, but I wondered if you could also talk briefly about what has the legacy been of these various law dissemination efforts throughout the history of the PRC.
A complicated one, probably. these 5-year plans have just went on, and we are now in, am I calculating correctly? I think in the 7th 5-year plan still, and every 5-year plan slightly shifts focus. At times, the dissemination of laws sort of it's practiced, but it is not as important as other forms of education. And then occasionally it sort of reappears very strongly in the broader network of CCP propaganda activities. Given recent developments in Xinjiang, I think there's a powerful story to be told now for law propaganda, and this idea of abiding by laws in the context of what is happening in Western China in very tragic ways. And so I think the legacy, there's no clear legacy that I could now outline in a nice and neat way, but it becomes law propaganda, and the popularization of law becomes, I think of it as a tool in the toolbox of the Chinese party state that reappears at moments when it is useful. At the same time, and I think I haven't managed to highlight this much in what I've said previously, the constant risk since the 50s or also before, but all the way until today, is of course that when you educate people broadly in laws, if only as a way to try and ensure that they understand laws correctly, that dissemination of knowledge means that people acquire a vocabulary with which they can understand their everyday life also in legal terms. Now, that was, of course, on the one hand, the goal, but that could in turn mean that people would and did and continue to compare what they have learned with what they see, experience in themselves and in their immediate environment. And so I think one of the most important reasons for me for writing this book was to show that state propaganda from the beginning of national rule under the CCP was heavily involved in helping people acquire legal knowledge. And this may, in some ways, at least help us to explain how people came to know the laws that then we have seen other scholars, famously Kevin O'Brien and others who look at contemporary China, show that people then are using this locally to claim their rights, or he calls it rights consciousness. Elizabeth Perry has called it rules consciousness, or in some way to say that what they're experiencing does not match what they know the law to be and their rights to be. And so in a way, I think that's for me the legacy, as I said, a complicated legacy, but the legacy of the 1950s all the way until today, that people don't just know about laws in China. They have, amongst others, acquired this legal knowledge by way of being educated in them under state auspices. So in some way, the state and party have always been involved in passing this knowledge on, which then gets used in ways that are not necessarily easy to control.
Fantastic. Well, Jen, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I do have one final question for you that is pretty traditional on this podcast. What are you working on now?
I've got a couple of things, a couple of essays on aspects of legal history. I'm looking at the connection between Chinese jurists in the 1980s and jurists in Eastern European socialist countries. I also want to explore this idea of the materiality of law a little more, because that some of that stuck with me. But for a bigger project, I have decided to leave law completely and to look instead at a new book, hopefully, which I've tentatively called Material Maoism, which explores everyday industrial design in the People's Republic of China, again, from the 50s all the way until the 1990s, but looking at the kind of material, the kind of materiality in everyday material life of people, from very, you know, very ordinary furniture, everyday ordinary objects, and to examine how that creates, there's a sort of creates a socialist society, or a society that people associate materially with the political ideology of socialism.
Sounds
good. It should be fun.
Yeah.
I'm learning a lot of chemistry in order to understand how plastics are produced.
Oh, goodness. That's great. Okay. So, Jen, thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and goodbye.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Lori Dickmeyer. Thank you for listening.